From the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is Good Weekend Talks, and I'm Conrad Marshall. Join us as we take a deep dive into the definitive stories of the day, brought to life here and in the pages of Good Weekend magazine. In this episode, we look at our cover story by Chief Political Correspondent David Crowe on the release of the hotly anticipated Malcolm Turnbull memoir, A Bigger Picture. The profile piece interrogates the many revelations from our former Prime Minister on everything from climate change failure to clashes with Tony Abbott. Today, David will be joined by Katrina Strickland, the editor of Good Weekend, for a discussion of the man, the book, and the reactions we might expect. But first, actor Nick English will read the story in full, so sit down, remain socially distant, and have a listen to Malcontent.
Malcolm Turnbull takes the wheel of the majestic old yacht and sets course for Southhead on Sydney Harbour. He's coming last in this, an annual race to raise money for disability charity Making Waves. But if the 65-year-old is peeved, he's showing no sign of it. To the contrary, the country's former Prime Minister is enjoying his time in command of Southwinds, a 1950s gem so laden with polished mahogany, including a wooden bathtub under deck, that he cannot hope to catch the fiberglass races up ahead. All of a sudden, the rest of the fleet is coming back at us, their Kevlar sails catching every bit of the 20-knot wind on a perfect day with blue sky and smooth waters. The old salts who own and crew Southwinds, a labour of love for a group of Sydney journalists, architects and other professionals, pause their easygoing conversation and exchange glances. The oncoming yachts are on a port tacked and obliged to give way, but it's a tricky moment all the same. "Hold your course," one of the crew tells Turnbull. He needn't have said a word. Turnbull lives for a game of chicken. He may not be in front, but he's in a contest, and he loves every minute. The wheel does not budge. Turnbull has such a colourful history of confrontation that his enemies might expect him to swerve toward an oncoming boat just to see its owner flinch. The man who took on governments, royal commissions, media moguls and politicians, prize target Tony Abbott, has a reputation for demolishing everyone in his way. Old Malcolm would rage against his rivals, scheme for advantage, and rejoice in victory with a supremely confident grin. As a lawyer, then investment banker, old Malcolm trounced the British government in the 1987 Spycatcher trial, securing publication of a book then British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher wanted to suppress. In the same decade, he saved media mogul Kerry Packer from a royal commission into drug deals and murder. And, in 1994, he put $500,000 into one of Australia's earliest internet companies, Oz Email, collecting $60 million from its sale within 5 years. He took cash, not shares, at the height of the 1990s dot-com boom. Sometimes he ended up in a dry gully, like the failed 1999 campaign for a republic, when he was head of the Australian Republican movement. But he never stopped his onward march. Relentless? Always. Ruthless? Whenever required. There's no sign of that furious energy on this sunny Friday in early March, however, with Turnbull happily at the wheel or helping on the winch. Once the other yachts have surged past, he relaxes with the Southwind's crew, pointing out the 19th century gun emplacements at Camp Cove and Neilson Park, where he played as a boy. He seems at peace with the world, at least for a while. Then, the conversation turns towards climate change, bushfires, and the federal government he once led. His restless energy returns, perhaps some of that old fury too. Turnbull has been a private citizen for more than 18 months now, since the insanely turbulent leadership spill that drove him from power and installed Scott Morrison in his place as Prime Minister. Turnbull quit federal parliament shortly after that August 2018 coup, rather than take a seat on the back bench. Despite saying that he would not be a miserable ghost like other former Prime Ministers, a private remark made to a small group in New York that September, where at least one phone was set to record, he has not gone quietly. To the contrary, Turnbull engages constantly with the urgency on the climate change dispute that exploded during his leadership and continues today. Whether by tweet or speech, he throws verbal grenades to trouble the man who now sits in the PM's chair. "We have to reduce emissions urgently," he tweeted in the days before Christmas, when bushfires raged and Morrison was on holiday. At an energy conference in February, he called on the government to adopt a net zero emissions target for 2050 and said the alternative was a further rise in global temperatures. "It is an absolutely unthinkable, catastrophic, apocalyptic scenario," he warned, to applause from the energy experts in the room. He insists today that not being a miserable ghost was a reference to those who stay in Parliament to plot revenge, in other words, Kevin Rudd and Tony Abbott, and that leaving Canberra did not mean taking a vow of silence. "I said I didn't want to be hanging around looking like someone waiting to trip up their successor," Turnbull tells me. "I'm sure Morrison would be gratified if every day I went out and said what a wonderful job he was doing. But the public commentary I've made has been almost entirely limited to the issue of climate and energy policy, which is a subject I've been passionate about for many years." Now, with a new memoir to be released on Monday, Turnbull will be throwing more than a few grenades. Prepare for missile strikes. The book, A Bigger Picture, damns those who turned against him in the 2018 coup and lifts the lid on the personal and policy disputes of those times. There are sharp observations about the way Morrison manoeuvred himself into the leadership, the way former Nationals leader Barnaby Joyce fell from grace after his affair with an advisor, and the way Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton lost out in a chaotic bid for power. The duplicity of politics is there on the page, in the form of private messages stored on Turnbull's phone from those who tore him down. The book begins with the account of a carefree childhood that came to an end when Turnbull's mother, Coral Lansbury, left him at age 10 to be raised by his beloved father, Bruce. "Her absence crept up on me, like a slow chill around the heart," he writes. After the bullying of boarding school, Turnbull turned to corporate life, which appears to have been one adventure after another. With verve and wit, he describes how Kerry Packer shocked English lawyers with talk of murder, strictly theoretical, of course. And US President Donald Trump bemused fellow leaders at a global summit by asking Turnbull how he kept Packer out of jail. In between the extraordinary highs, he tells of the biggest lows, describing in detail for the first time the depression that took hold of him a decade ago, when he felt humiliated and alone, discarded by his party in the leadership spill of December 2009. A natural raconteur as well as compulsive note-taker, Turnbull fills almost 700 pages with anecdotes from a life that spanned law, banking and politics, including a sly reference to Abbott and his former chief of staff, Peter Credlin. "Peter has always strongly denied that she and Tony were lovers," he writes. "But if they were, that would have been the most unremarkable aspect of their friendship." He tells of Abbott being asleep on a lounge after dinner and wine with friends when he should have been in Parliament to vote on an economic stimulus. He recounts Morrison's briefings to favoured journalists during his time as Treasurer, while Finance Minister Matthias Cormann vents his frustration at the damage. "We have a Treasurer problem." He describes former Resources Minister Matt Canavan confounding Energy Australia boss Catherine Tanner with a plan for a new coal-fired power station. She declared it batshit crazy. And he tells of his shock at Cormann's desertion in August 2018 and the plot to put Dutton in the lodge. "So this is revenge, right?" "Absolutely not," Turnbull says. We're sitting in the conference room of his office, high above Circular Quay in Sydney, looking out at the harbour he was sailing on a few days earlier. "Clearly people will have different perspectives and indeed different recollections. Politics is a very tough business, and in many respects an unedifying one. But an account of a political life has to be factual. If it's not, then it's of diminished value." His objective, he says, is simply to set the record straight. Wearing a blue checked shirt with no tie, Turnbull looks much the same as any politician campaigning in smart casual. In a sense, he's going into political battle again. The book is guaranteed to reignite the rage of a legion of haters, the liberals who cannot bear his criticisms on climate change, the commentators who rejoiced in his downfall, the editors loyal to Rupert Murdoch and eager to paint him as black as possible. So, Turnbull has to be ready to defend every word. A cruise ship lies motionless on the harbour during our interview. We see it and talk briefly about the COVID-19 virus spreading on so many ships, the full enormity of which is yet to take hold. This is the week Morrison insists he'll still go to the football that weekend. As the crisis worsens, Turnbull talks to his old friend Sandy Grant, whose company, Hardy Grant, is publishing his memoir, about postponing the launch. It's too late. The 40,000 print run is already underway, and booksellers are counting on it to lift sales. The book goes ahead. As for the Murdoch media, they'll attack me regardless of when I publish or what I say. Turnbull has more time than ever to do the things he loves these days, not least kayaking around Sydney Harbour from a boat shed below his Point Piper home. He and his wife Lucy have a loving family, with son Alex, a fund manager in Singapore, and daughter Daisy, a schoolteacher in Sydney. Turnbull's social media accounts regularly feature his grandchildren, Jack, Isla, Alice, and Ronan. He has a beautiful home, loyal friends, and a personal fortune that was worth about $180 million before the coronavirus pandemic struck. So, if he dares to mention any troubles, plenty of Australians will tell him to talk to the hand. But few can know how it feels to be thrown from power, twice, in acts of political violence that turn someone from a leader to a has-been overnight. We sometimes dismiss our former politicians with the joke about relevance deprivation syndrome, a term coined by former Labour Foreign Minister Gareth Evans when he lost power after his party was swept from office in 1996. Turnbull has not told this side of his story before. His new book contains passages from his diaries that speak of depression and suicidal thoughts after the humiliation of defeat. Not that of August 2018, but the one in December 2009, when he lost the Liberal Party leadership to Tony Abbott after an uprising against his proposal to vote for the Rudd government's emissions trading scheme. He was especially ashamed of his part in the Utegate affair that year, when he attacked then Prime Minister Kevin Rudd on the basis of an email released by public servant Godwin Gretsch, who admitted days later that it was a fake. He apologised to Rudd, but the shame remained and deepened the sense that he was finished. "I feel at present like a complete and utter failure," he wrote in his diary on April 20, 2010, 2 weeks after announcing he'd leave Parliament at the next election. "Having lost the leadership, I sank deeper and deeper into depression. Couldn't make up my mind whether to stay or go, and was finally persuaded to say I would go when it was obvious I should stay." He considered a political rebirth unlikely, but was in a torment of indecision. Could he backflip and announce that he would stay in Parliament after all? He felt that this would only add to his humiliation. The answer is the pain will end at some point. "Suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary, we hope, problem," he wrote. "But frankly, I am thinking about dying all the time." Daisy Turnbull Brown was chilled by these diary entries when she read them in the manuscript for the new book. She'd known at the time that her father was depressed, but not the extent of it. She remembers a walk along a beach promenade when she thought her job was to talk happily and cheer him up. "Now I realize that what people need is for you to sit in the poo with them and listen," she says. Turnbull himself buried some of the memories. The diary from that time was locked in a computer file called Darkness, protected by a password he'd forgotten. Only when he began writing did the password resurface. With it came memories of the antidepressants he took, some of them doing more harm than good, and the professional help he received. 10 days after that diary entry, Turnbull announced he'd changed his mind and would stay in Parliament. His recovery began, but it was a slow climb. in one recent conversation with a friend, he likened it to climbing out of a pit by his fingernails. I ask whether the depression crept up on him or hit all at once. "A bit of both, really," he says, talking dispassionately in his office. It sort of crept up on me. Then it started to dawn on me how sick I was. I ask if he could talk to other politicians about it at the time. "You can't, really. You can't," he says. And he's right. The world of politics makes it dangerous to declare a vulnerability to those around you, whether they're declared enemies or notional allies. Yet the risk to mental health is everywhere. "Parliament and politics is full of people battling depression," he says. I mean, it's obvious, particularly when you've been through it yourself and you see. Life has its shares of ups and downs and triumphs and disasters for everybody, right? The problem with politics is the intensity of those experiences is so much greater, and the fact you are doing it in the public arena. The degree of vilification that people in politics endure and inflict on each other, it's a terrible business. The depression was terrifying, but he learnt to manage it. If you do have a vulnerability to it, and probably the reality is the majority of us do, to some extent or another, it's not unique. What you've got to do is just be very alert to it, and make sure you manage yourself in mundane ways, like getting out in the sunshine and exercising and all that stuff. This shaped his thinking years later when he became Prime Minister. Knowing he would one day lose the job, he chose to stay in his own home in Sydney rather than move to the official residence at Kirribilli House. It didn't help his image. Credlin famously called him Mr. Harbourside Mansion, but he had his reasons. I just thought, well, if I change my whole living environment, then when I stop being Prime Minister, that will be a huge shift, he says. The good thing about staying in the one house is that there's continuity. One morning you get out of bed and you're not Prime Minister, but you're still in the same bed, in the same house, and in the same surroundings. Depression struck again in 2018 when he lost power and left Parliament, a man suddenly redundant. His wife Lucy believes the sheer speed of his removal made the experience worse, but also notes that he'd studied the science on mental health and learnt from the past. There were no antidepressants this time. He had some pretty dark moments, but he knew the signals, she says. He knew what made it get better. He knew what he had to do. So he had a coping mechanism. Bruised by the political violence of the 2018 coup, the Turnbulls moved to Manhattan, settling for 6 weeks into their apartment, purchase price, $4.8 million US, but who's counting? During that time, they reconnected with a social network formed during a shared lifetime in the law, banking, and politics. Cycling through the stages of shock and grief, Turnbull also cycled 30 kilometres or more on most days. He caught up with an old friend, Harold Evans, editor of the UK Sunday Times from 1967 to 1981. One of the formative moments in Turnbull's life came in 1976, when Evans saw him at a Cambridge University debate. Turnbull was visiting during the Australian summer break and warned him, in good humour, against going into politics. Turnbull has remained in touch with Evans, now 91, and his wife Tina Brown, the former editor of Vanity Fair and The New Yorker. "He was stunning in the debate, speaking from the floor," Evans recalls. In touch from New York, he tells me that Turnbull's downfall as Prime Minister was Australia's loss. "I thought he was adept and fluent, and much regret his betrayal by blockheads and the Murdoch press. He was spot on about climate change." Turnbull spent days with English movie director Paul Greengrass, best known for the Jason Bourne thrillers starring Matt Damon, and a friend from the 1980s, when he co-wrote Spycatcher and stayed with Malcolm and Lucy for 6 weeks in Sydney during the trial. Roaming Central Park, he and Turnbull debated the erosion of the middle ground in politics. A moderate Labour man who saw his party driven to disaster at the 2019 British election under leader Jeremy Corbyn, Greengrass sympathised with Turnbull over his defeat at the hands of the Conservatives within the Liberal Party. Turnbull also had time to consider the events that brought him down. Only after the coup did all the machinations become clear. In his book, he offers his most thorough explanation for the decision that astonished his colleagues on Tuesday, August 21, 2018, when he declared the leadership vacant in a morning party room meeting and gave Dutton a chance to challenge him. He thought Morrison's supporters were less likely to back Dutton in that scenario than vote for a motion to spill the leadership, an alternative that would have made it easier for Morrison to stand. This is crucial. For Turnbull, building a bulwark against Morrison was part of the plan from the start. The tactic failed when Turnbull won the ballot by only 48 to 35 votes, leading him to accept, according to his book, that half a dozen Morrison supporters had voted for Dutton to damage the incumbent and clear the way for their own candidate. Turnbull reveals that Morrison sent him a note that Tuesday as the ballots were counted. "I don't know why we didn't discuss this, but that's your call. Turnbull is on my ballot." Not enough of Morrison's camp followed their leader, however, leading Turnbull to the inevitable conclusion, documented in his memoir. If Morrison's friends had voted the way he said he did, the Dutton insurgency would have been utterly dead that morning. There's not a flicker of anger on Turnbull's face as I ask him about that week. He believes his government was in a winnable position in the polls, but was undermined by Abbott and undone by panicked politicians who joined a stampede. What he cannot wave away is the fact his government had lost 38 news polls in a row, worse than the benchmark he set when he challenged Abbott 3 years earlier on the grounds the former leader had lost 30 in a row. But that's not all. His opponents claim vindication from Morrison's election victory against Labour leader Bill Shorten 7 months after the spill, a result that owed as much to Morrison's cunning as it did to Shorten's complacency. Turnbull remains more puzzled than angry at the chaotic spill. "I've seen a lot of craziness and disappointing behaviour in politics, so I don't get too angry about it. But it was recklessly, pointlessly destructive." He says Morrison deserves credit for fighting hard in the election last May, but believes the coalition only won because Labour fumbled its campaign. "That was an election that we all know Labour lost," he says. "Scott was able to win, but we did not win in May 2019 thanks to the coup. We won despite it. That's the truth." Whose betrayal hurt the most? I would have to say Cormann's conduct disappointed me the most because, for a start, we had become good friends. In Turnbull's book, which includes text messages from Cormann himself, the finance minister is portrayed as helping to do the numbers for Dutton while claiming to support Turnbull. What he called an insurgency at the time still looks like terrorism to Turnbull. He believes the conservative faction within the Liberal Party will bully everyone else to get its way. Certainly the conservatives never paused in their campaign against him in his final year at the top. The title of Annabel Crabb's 2009 essay on Turnbull, "Stop at Nothing," can just as easily describe those who tore him down in 2018. They were merciless. Labour has engaged in its share of bloodletting, of course, and Turnbull was implacable against Abbott in 2015, so who's he to condemn the brutality of an opponent? Even so, he believes the Conservative cabal is wrecking the Liberal Party. That tactic, the preparedness from many of them, supported by their friends in the media, to tear the joint down, even at the expense of going into opposition, is extraordinary, he says. Really, it raises a question. If an individual is prepared to blow up their own government in order to get rid of a rival, are they really fit to be in Parliament at all? Their defence, of course, is that they changed the government and held on to power, even if only narrowly. The coalition's slender victory at the May 2019 election will always undercut Turnbull's argument, because he can never prove he would have won. The nagging doubt will always be there. Morrison turned out to be a very effective retail politician. Can there be any forgiveness for those plotters? "I'm not a hater," Turnbull says. "Really?" "I'm not a grudge bearer. But do I want to go and have a beer with Matthias or Dutton or any of these characters?" "No." The answer is no. My political engagement with those people is over. The terse tone conveys the message. Let's move on. There's another version of Turnbull's adventures in politics, of course. In this tale, the upstart investment banker arrives in Canberra in 2004 and muscles his way into cabinet within 2 years, dripping with derision for the tired old ministers around him. When John Howard loses the 2007 election and Peter Costello decides to quit politics, Turnbull seeks the leadership and is furious when colleagues prefer Brendan Nelson by 45 to 42 votes. Turnbull harangues Nelson and waits for the party to come to its senses. 10 months later, by 45 to 41 votes, he rises to at last become leader of the Liberal Party, and the victory evaporates. Having lunged for the crown, the new leader falls to earth only 15 months later when, in December 2009, Tony Abbott wins the Liberal leadership, 42 to 41 votes. It takes years for Turnbull to climb his way back, but he does so. 9 months after, Abbott bestows a knighthood on Prince Philip, defeating Abbott, 54 to 44 votes, to secure the ultimate prize in September 2015. In this version of the tale, told by Turnbull's detractors, he schemes all the way. Turnbull never stayed in the Parliament to be someone else's minister, Abbott once told me. I knew Turnbull would be doing his best, by hook or by crook, to get the top job. I didn't think he had any realistic chance of succeeding. I turned out to be wrong. So many people have been on the wrong side of a Turnbull deal, losing out in a takeover, a courtroom drama, or leadership spill. He'll forever have critics saying he brought his fate upon himself. In this view, the man who did everything to achieve power was undone by his own arrogance. He finds it very difficult to work with anyone, says Nicholas Whitlam, who formed an investment bank with Turnbull and former New South Wales Labor Premier Neville Wran in 1986, but quit in acrimony a few years later. His fundamental problem, from when I was working with him, and from what I can see when he was in politics, is that people didn't like him. In his book, Turnbull says merely that he was sorry the partnership ended the way it did. Turnbull's friends see a very different man. Paul Greengrass, on the phone from his home in Surrey in the English countryside, says there's more to his character than the pugilistic lawyer. What stands out, he says, is the extreme curiosity Turnbull takes to everything in the world. He is one of the most intelligent people I have ever met in my life, in terms of his ability to distill and synthesize complex information. Greengrass has rarely commented in profiles of his friend, yet his perspective balances the invective from others. He lists what he knows of Turnbull after 35 years: the fierce intelligence, the infectious and wonderful sense of humor, the absolute driven doer, and the bit that people don't see so much, which is the great capacity for friendship and the great loyalty. If you're a friend with Malcolm, he'd cross many roads to help you if you're in trouble. He's a very, very conspicuously loyal friend. It sounds like Greengrass is pacing the room as he talks on speakerphone. He adds one last thought. He's a very great patriot, Malcolm. The Malcolm who is the robustious and competitive and professional politician, as most Australians probably know him, also has an extremely and beautiful sense of patriotism. It's not tub-thumping. It's about how to make the Australian future. With ambitions so great, why did Turnbull not achieve more? That question hangs over time in government, his rise to power coming with so many expectations, that he could set a course for a republic, enact same-sex marriage, and act on climate change. He addresses all three issues in his book, and knows his critics on the left will always wonder what might have been. On the Republic, he insists the hopes were always too high and that he'd argued since 1999, when Australians voted to keep the monarchy, that the question could not be put again during the reign of Queen Elizabeth II. There was literally zero change in my position on the Republic at all, he says. The sense of lost opportunity will always continue to frustrate staunch Republicans, but Turnbull has kept the loyalty of the movement he once led. When he restated this timetable at an Australian Republican movement dinner last November, the crowd gave him a standing ovation. On marriage equality, there was a moment at the end of 2015 when Turnbull, as new leader riding the euphoria of electoral approval, might have managed a free vote in Parliament to legislate the change. He chose instead to honour Abbott's commitment to hold a plebiscite, even though he'd argued against this idea when it first arose. It looked from the outside like a Faustian pact with the Nationals and Conservative Liberals, who had accepted Turnbull's rise on the condition he not rock the boat on something they opposed so deeply. "Once you promise people a public vote, it's very hard to take that away," Turnbull says now. "It would have been a mistake to put the stability of the government, which had already been rocked by the removal of Abbott, at risk at that time." He devotes a chapter of his book to the tortured political path, to the November 2017 postal survey and parliamentary vote. One moment reveals Morrison utterly deflated by the passage of marriage equality. Turnbull acknowledges the pain for LGBTQI+ Australians in the public ballot process compared to the swifter result a conscience vote might have delivered, and is careful not to claim all the glory. "We managed to get it done," he writes, calling it the most enduring reform of his government. The failure on climate grieves Turnbull to this day. He lost the Liberal Party leadership in 2009 for supporting Labor's plan for a price on carbon. He lost it again in 2018 by attempting a different mechanism to reduce emissions, the National Energy Guarantee, NEG. The attempt to formalise the cut to carbon emissions to a target the government had already set was impossible to avoid when industry demanded legislated certainty. But it gave Abbott the issue he needed to fuel unrest and created the conditions for Dutton to challenge. Upon his promotion, Morrison declared the NEG dead. In his exile, Turnbull calls for it to be revived. He goes further than he did in government by embracing the net zero target for 2050. The coalition is held hostage by a climate-denying group within it, backed up by their supporters in the media, mostly the Murdoch media, he says. But he believes he was right to try to compromise with his Liberal and National colleagues to establish the NEG with a 26-28% target for 2030. Even when climate activists dismissed this as too weak. "To criticise a politician for compromising is like criticising a fish for swimming," he says. "You know, politics is all about compromise and negotiation and finding a way to get your desired objective. The trouble for Turnbull in his epic struggle with Abbott was that no compromise on climate change was ever enough. Abbott, a political killing machine like no other, just kept coming at him." The critics who label Turnbull a failure on this subject infuriate his daughter Daisy. "The guy lost his job twice over climate change," she says. "You can't say he doesn't have any conviction about it." Others acknowledge the hurdles Turnbull had to jump in less than 3 years as Prime Minister. Emma Hurd, chief executive of the Investor Group on Climate Change, does not lay all the blame at his feet. "The collapse of the National Energy Guarantee is symptomatic of a broad failure of Australian politics," she says. Mark Howden, director of the Climate Change Institute at the Australian National University, believes the outcome might have been different if Turnbull had been leader when last summer's bushfires increased public concern about the environment. "He had the right idea at the wrong time," Howden says. "The headwinds in his party were too strong to put those ideas into action." The Making Waves sailing race finished, having raised $100,000 from the charity day. The beers are flowing at the cruising yacht club at Darling Point, one of Sydney's flashier suburbs. It's a sunny Friday afternoon, and Turnbull is sharing old stories. Standing near the bar, he jumps from tale to tale with a chuckle at the memory of his clashes with plutocrats and presidents. He recalls Donald Trump's reaction to the surreptitious video that caught Turnbull impersonating the US president at the Federal Parliamentary Press Gallery's Midwinter Ball 3 years ago. The video went viral and outraged conservatives, but Turnbull swears it did not offend the world's most powerful man. "I hear you've been impersonating me," Trump told Turnbull when they next spoke. "They say you're better than Alec Baldwin." Trump was not always so easygoing. In a private phone call that was sensationally leaked, he berated Turnbull for insisting on a deal agreed with his predecessor Barack Obama for the United States to accept refugees from Manus Island and Nauru in return for Australia taking refugees from Central America. Turnbull's chapter on Trump is one of the most entertaining in his memoir, with a lively account of their conversations and an assessment that Trump was much wilier than his critics thought. Once the refugee deal was done, He moved on with no hard feelings. The anecdotes are interrupted by young men and women in the club bar seeking a photograph with the former Prime Minister. He takes one of their phones and snaps a selfie in a swift procedure he's repeated countless times. Hundreds of people are now gathered for the charity to confirm the race winners and celebrate the cash it's raised for people with disabilities. Helped by a cheque from the Turnbull Foundation, which gives away about $600,000 a year to health, education and research. The stories continue once the speeches are over. As volunteers cook a giant paella on the club balcony and serve it up on paper plates, Turnbull tucks in with the team and recalls his life with Kerry Packer. He is astonished now that one of Australia's richest men hired him when he was only 28 to be his legal attack dog. That's incredible when you think that he had one of the biggest businesses in Australia, Turnbull says. Not that he admitted any surprise at the time. Supremely confident, he swung a wrecking ball through Packer's enemies. Turnbull punctuates his stories with a wave of his iPhone. He still has the old documents to prove every point. "Just let me find it," he says with a murmur. He calls up a scanned image on his phone. It's a faded and torn paper from the Costigan corruption inquiry decades ago, a document that was left in a box at his family farm until recently when he had it digitized. When the time comes to speak about his books, the facts will always be at his fingertips. Two confrontations from those years highlight how Turnbull would charge his opponents from the wheel of a legal bulldozer at full throttle. In the first, he launched an onslaught at the Costigan Royal Commission when the National Times newspaper published leaked case summaries about a man named the Goanna, who was obviously Packer. In his book, Turnbull tells of the police detective who told him the leak had come from the counsel assisting the commission, Douglas Marr. This was the basis for Turnbull's attempt to sue Marr for libel, a tactic so brazenly unconventional it earned him a warning from the court that he was trying to poison the fountain of justice. The editor of the newspaper at the time, Brian Toohey, has stated that the leak did not come from Marr, but that will not stop Turnbull resuming the assault almost four decades later. The second confrontation was far more violent. Years after saving his patron, Turnbull joined Packer in the Turang Consortium to rescue the Fairfax newspaper group from the folly of its young owner, Warwick Fairfax. Public resistance to Packer's ambitions grew so strong that the Nine Network mogul tried to save his bid by forcing out those who were perceived to be too close to him, starting with his former chief executive, Trevor Kennedy, then moving on Turnbull himself. Packer could not be seen to control a rival media company, so he drove his old allies off the board. Turnbull's billionaire benefactor had dropped him cold. What happened next is the stuff of media legend. Even if Turnbull is reluctant to elaborate on his revenge, the apprentice turned on his master in spectacular fashion. With the Australian Broadcasting Tribunal looking into the Packer moves, Tribunal Chairman Peter Westaway stopped his car in Kirribilli one night to receive a package of documents from a man he knew but agreed not to name. Included were Kennedy's explosive diary notes about Packer's plans to control Fairfax. Westaway launched a public inquiry, Packer pulled out of Turang, and the bid proceeded, with Turnbull collecting a handsome fee as a lawyer for bondholders with a stake in the bid. Who was that mysterious man in the Kirribilli darkness? Turnbull shifts in his chair in his Sydney conference room when I ask him about that night. He admitted to Annabel Crabb in a 2009 essay that he handed the documents to Westaway because he thought Packer was out to get him. "Kerry got a bit out of control at that time," he told Crabb. "He told me he'd kill me." Yet he hedges now. "A lot of this is lost in the midst of time," he says in our interview. "I had a discussion with Westaway at that time, but I don't believe I gave him the Trevor diaries. In fact, I don't think I'd actually seen them at that point. Anyway, the bottom line is what I said to Annabel related to some threats Kerry made against me, which I deeply regretted having recounted, and I resolved I wouldn't repeat." His voice trails off, and he sits in silence for a moment as he scrolls through his phone looking for something. He murmurs to himself, "Soon he's out of his chair and out of the room, leaving me to contemplate the distant harbour." He returns with a battered laptop and sits thoughtfully in a search through his past. "Just give me one second," he says. It takes a minute. It takes minutes, but he finds it. A letter from the 25th of November, 1991, that shows Kennedy sent the diary notes to the tribunal in response to a subpoena. I can't recall what went on in that meeting with Westaway. The most that I could have done was encourage him to subpoena the diary. It was a very fraught time. He's kept his vow of silence on parts of these events. Turnbull does not recount Packer's threat in his book, nor the meeting with Westaway. But this is where Malcolm Turnbull double-crossed Kerry Packer, I tell him in his office. That's basically what he did. Well, that's not right, Turnbull says. I tried to persuade him not to sack Trevor. I thought it was insane, just completely insane. And then he turned on me. As I say in the book, madness is not limited to politics. And the lesson was, you will defend yourself. Totally, he says. A small girl is playing in a park with pieces of bark in her hand, collecting pretend money for the imaginary cakes she's selling on a table-sized block of Sydney sandstone. Alice, age 3.5, is doing brisk business with her grandparents, Malcolm and Lucy, but suddenly she changes the game. The ground beneath their feet becomes a lake they need to cross, their only route along the sandstone blocks. Alice looks at Turnbull. The former Prime Minister hops obediently from rock to rock. It's a weekday in early March, and Daisy has collected Alice from childcare. Time in the park with the grandchildren is easier now that Turnbull has left politics, and seems easier again when the COVID-19 virus forces Malcolm and Lucy to cancel their overseas travel. They do not know it, but this is one of the last times for a while that the older generation will play with the youngest. Alice crunches a green apple and brushes sand off the seesaw, cross at the mess. Who put that there? Turnbull, famous for being so confrontational and combustible, walks contentedly with Alice and Daisy to pose for photographs. There's no sign here of raging Turnbull, the man described in a Good Weekend profile in 1991. Humility is for saints, he told journalist John Lyons back then. These days, Turnbull says humility is about realizing you're not always right. Big news for those who've been on the wrong side of a Turnbull negotiation. But he feels unfairly tagged by that notorious quote. What I was really saying was that very few of us are able to be truly humble, he says. And of course, the thing about politics is that you've got to get yourself going every day in the face of endless reams of criticism. To some extent, some politicians are better able to do their job by being less self-aware than in a normal line of work you would ideally want to be. Perhaps you have to leave the trade to become human again. Is this the mellowing of Malcolm? He's landed more steadily in this fall from power than he did a decade ago. Writing the book was a risk. Reliving the coup could easily revive the rage, but its publication clears the way for what will follow. Lucy stepped down in March as chief of the Greater Sydney Commission and is throwing herself into online study in areas including urban planning. Turnbull is advising global investment firm KKR on private equity deals and investing his own money in Australian technology firms. On public policy, he'll keep speaking up. The issue that I'm most concerned about remains climate change. I remain committed to doing everything I can to ensure the world cuts its greenhouse gas emissions. Turnbull will never stop shooting poison darts at those who brought him undone, especially when old adversaries block action on climate change. He will defend his record, his government, and himself. But he has reached the pinnacle of Australian public life and, so far at least, appears to be walking on without tears. I don't miss the politics of politics, if you know what I mean, he says. I miss government. I miss being able to make policy, make decisions. That's true even now, perhaps especially now, as Australia faces the coronavirus crisis. Some people have said to me, aren't you glad you don't have to be responsible? Well, it's quite the contrary. I wish I was in a position to make a contribution, to be able to make the decisions, and to make sure we make the right decisions. He knew the Prime Minister's job came with a time limit. It's always going to have an end, and my time as Prime Minister came to an end, frankly, a few years earlier than I would have liked. There's regret in his voice, but no grief. If this is Zen, he speaks like someone who's emerged from the temple, a master. I never imagined I'd run again in 2022. My absolute expectation was that I would not run again in 2022, simply because of age, frankly. He knows other leaders have had similar ideas and changed their minds. In his case, others made up his mind for him. "I'm thirsty," says Alice. We walk up the hill in search of a banana smoothie at the local shops. As the family sit in a cafe courtyard with Alice pouring pretend tea from a plastic teapot, Turnbull is already thinking ahead. He voices the constant question of his life. "So, what are we up to next?"
This episode of Good Weekend Talks discusses depression and suicide. If you would like to talk to someone, please call Beyond Blue on 1300 224 636 or Lifeline on 131 114.
Hello, my name's Katrina Strickland. I'm the editor of Good Weekend magazine. Joining me today to have a conversation about Malcolm Turnbull's new memoir, A Bigger Picture, is David Crowe, Chief Political Correspondent for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Welcome, David.
Hi, Katrina.
How did you find it regard to memoirs of other political leaders?
Well, I really enjoyed the writing. He had that background as a journalist, so he has this great way of telling a tale, and I think that's really fundamental to the book. The book's 680 plus pages, so there's quite a lot to read there, but it's thinner than John Howard's autobiography, Lazarus Rising, which has got a lot of fans as a political memoir. But the careers are very different, aren't they? Because there's so much of Malcolm Turnbull's life story that's about life before politics, whereas John Howard was a political animal from the start. And so there is something about his early life, but then it very quickly moves into the political life of Canberra. I mean, the other comparison, I guess, is with Kevin Rudd, who did two big volumes, the second on his life as Prime Minister, and the first volume, which is about his early life and then his political career. So compared to some of those others, it's a shorter and racier read.
Do you feel, I know you talk in the Good Weekend piece, that perhaps he's mellowed. Is that a really strong sense that came through when you talked to him, that he's less of that really hard-ass person, do you think?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, in a deal, in a negotiation, he would still be completely hard. I mean, he would be as ruthless as necessary to get the outcome that he wants. He has basically reached all the places in his political career and his business career that he wanted to. I mean, he had a very successful career in law and investment banking, and then he reached the top in politics. So I think there is an acceptance of his fate and his removal against his own wishes, and so that has mellowed him to a certain extent.
He talks about the depression that he suffered in 2009 and his suicidal thoughts around that time. Were you surprised to read about that?
It's only really in this book that the full scale of that is revealed. He got so down, he was thinking about death all the time. He writes in his diary, which he later recovered, about suicide. So it was a much deeper fall than I think anybody really knew from the outside at the time. And I found that to be some of the most interesting parts of the book.
It seems a very common response among politicians, yet as you say in your piece, they can't tell anyone about it. Is that an indictment on our political system or really just a reality that anyone entering the field should get used to?
I think it is always going to be like that. I was interviewing him in his Sydney office and I asked him about his depression. I asked him a couple of times after that as well in phone calls just to be clear on a couple of points as I was writing the feature. And it was interesting that he was quite unwilling to elaborate on his depression in the interview beyond what was in the book. He'd always say things like, "Oh, look, you've got to read the book, it's in the book." So it was still difficult for him to talk about it to somebody across the table. What I found really interesting talking to him about this was the indecision made his depression so much worse. And his advice was, get out, exercise, get out in the open, out in the sun, and don't make big decisions, because when you're in that frame of mind, indecision or the wrong decision can make it so much worse. It was an interesting reflection. Once he had decided to stay in politics and set his course, he actually started working through it and getting better. When he was depressed, He was about 56 years old, so he got to a point in his political career where he was wondering about where he was going and what he was doing. But also there'd been things that he'd been going through where he was basically ashamed of himself. And that's another interesting reflection in the book. He was ashamed of what he had done as opposition leader when he'd attacked Kevin Rudd over the Utegate affair. He'd relied on an email from a government official, which later turned out to be fake. He apologised to Kevin Rudd for doing that. But he writes about the shame that he felt. Of course, in politics, you don't know who you trust. They say if you want a friend, get a dog.
One of the other things that came through was the importance of Lucy. What's your sense of her influence on his career?
It's always been known that she's been a very close advisor, but it is interesting throughout the book. She's always there. And I remember, Katrina, when I was working on the feature and you said after you looked at one of the drafts, there's not really enough Lucy in that. You were spot on, because it was interesting when I set up the interviews. I visited Turnbull in a park in Sydney, where he was catching up with his daughter Daisy and her daughter Alice. And, you know, I just got to see a bit of the family time. But it was interesting that Lucy didn't want to be in the photograph, and she didn't really want to talk at that stage. It was only later, when I got back to her and talked to her on the phone, that she was willing to shed a bit of light. From the start, she thought with this feature that she really wouldn't be part of it. But it was very important, actually, to get her reflections.
That's right. And what about their children, Alex and Daisy? Are either of them got any kind of political aspirations, do you think?
Alex is a real troublemaker, isn't he? Because he was politically active in the last federal election campaign by funding candidates who were independent candidates making trouble for Scott Morrison. Now, that didn't succeed much. So I think he'll always be engaged. It's interesting with Daisy. She's a schoolteacher in Sydney. She writes fascinating things, actually, about some of her lessons. Her husband, James Brown, has expressed interest, I think, in becoming a Liberal candidate, but it didn't work last time. I think you would never say never on that front.
One of Turnbull's main points is that the middle ground is in danger of being lost in politics in general, but in the Liberal Party in particular. Is that the case, and is it a big problem, and how can it be changed if so?
I think it is a big problem. I think the analysis of the situation that's in the Turnbull memoir will be important for the future, because people will look back at this time as a time of a fracturing of consensus, a fracturing of that sense of unity. For the Liberal Party, the last 10 years have been a time of incredible division, still unresolved. We'll always see those tensions emerge, especially on climate change. So I think looking back in years to come, the stories told in the Turnbull memoir will be interesting for the light that they shed on those tensions.
And climate change is interesting. That's another thread through the book, isn't it? Because he says compromise is inherent in politics, and his daughter Daisy tells you that he lost his job twice over climate change, so you can't say that he didn't try. Where's the truth in all of that, do you think?
Now, to readers, I think the response to the book will very much depend on their views on climate change and the need or not to do anything about it. Now, those who think that Malcolm Turnbull was going too hard on climate change will be disappointed with him, and I don't think the book will change their minds. Similarly, those who thought that he never fought hard enough on climate change, well, it's possible the book will change their mind, but I think some of them have dug into that position anyway. But it does give him a chance to explain why he made the decisions he did. It was a day before he called a leadership spill, and he chose to be extremely cautious, not to bring on a fight in Parliament, not to split his own party on climate change. And in a sense, his judgment in 2018 was shaped by the fact that he tried to force the issue in 2009 and lost the leadership. In a sense, he could not win. He tried a different approach in 2018. He lost the leadership anyway, because that issue, climate change, is just so toxic within his own party.
The enmity between Malcolm Turnbull and Tony Abbott seems epic and stems back to the leadership tussles of the late 2000s. How did this rate on the political enmity scale? Is it one of the most bitter of all time?
It's so different to most of the other clashes that we've seen. Paul Keating and Bob Hawke were two titans in a way. They're both, you know, major leaders, and one challenged the other. But there was that element of reconciliation towards the very end, because after all, they were fighting for the same cause a lot of the time on the same side. Here it was people who stood for very different things. Malcolm, socially moderate, in favour of same-sex marriage, wanting action on climate change. Tony Abbott, socially conservative, dead against same-sex marriage, really pushing back against any action on climate change, even though he made some decisions of his own in favour of action. It makes it one of the deepest and most bitter personality clashes in Australian politics. I think you have to go back decades to find something similar.
Do you think that they'll ever make up? Can you ever foresee that?
Never. It'll never happen. It's interesting that there's so much bitterness among Tony Abbott and his supporters, like Peter Credlin. They feel that they were undermined constantly by Malcolm Turnbull when Tony Abbott was Prime Minister. But I think, you know, from the perspective of me, and I think other journalists in the press gallery would, I think they would see it the same way. The undermining of Malcolm Turnbull by Tony Abbott was on a completely different scale. And so, in a sense, it was so much more brutal. That means that, in a sense, the bitterness deepened. The hatreds only got worse as time went on, and I don't see time healing those.
So, David, what's your sense of what Malcolm Turnbull will do now? I mean, he's not old enough to retire, is he?
No, there's still a lot that he can do. And he is active as an investor. He's active in the technology space. That's an area that's always been of interest to him. And he is basically an angel investor. If somebody out there in Australia has got a smart idea on the technology area, then Malcolm Turnbull is the kind of angel investor who'll give them that early money and get them going. The one thing where we know he's going to stay active is climate change. I think in terms of protecting and defending his legacy as a politician and prime minister, he'll still be very active on climate change and he'll keep speaking up. And that's where he'll continue to cause trouble for Scott Morrison over time, because I think with the Liberal Party room the way it is, it's very difficult for Scott Morrison to keep everybody on his own side happy on the issue of climate change. And so I think Malcolm Turnbull will keep up his criticism from the outside. He's also interested in other areas where he wants to defend his legacy as Prime Minister, things like trade, regional trade agreements in the Asia Pacific, relations with Japan, relations with Indonesia. He's a huge fan of Joko Widodo. I don't see any sign yet that he's wanting to take up a particular, you know, company directorships in Australia or anything like that. But again, that landscape's been affected by the coronavirus, and so there might have been things he could have done that might be off the table now.
It must be hard if you were once the Prime Minister to watch the reaction to COVID-19 and wonder what you would do the same, what you would do differently, how you'd be handling it. Did you get a sense from him of how difficult that is, seeing, you know, this is the biggest story of any of our lives?
I think that's very difficult for him. We'll see that Malcolm Turnbull will start expressing his opinion about current affairs. He's never really silent, right? Let's face it, he'll always fire off a tweet if he's feeling that something needs to be said. But yes, I do think he finds it extremely difficult to be looking at all of this from the outside. I don't think that's just him. I think politicians are like that generally. They do get into it because they think that they're the ones who are there to do the best job. They can do a better job than the others, and that they deserve the promotion to do that work. They have to have that self-belief to actually want to get into politics. And let's face it, Malcolm Turnbull certainly has that self-belief, and he's looking at the government now, and he was quite frank when I asked him about this. Yes, even now, when the government's dealing with a huge crisis, he would still rather be in government working on those policies, getting something done. He doesn't miss the politics of it all and the backstabbing and so forth, but he misses being able to get that work done.
If you're enjoying this podcast, please remember to subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. And remember to rate and comment on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Good Weekend Talks is brought to you by the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Subscriptions power our writers. To support independent journalism, search Subscribe Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. This episode was produced and edited by Anu Hasbold, with editorial assistance from Conrad Marshall and technical assistance from Cormac Lally. Tom McKendrick is head of audio, and Katrina Strickland is the editor of Good Weekend. I'm Conrad Marshall. Thanks for listening.